Hello and welcome. This is 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. I am Douglas Bowles, and before we begin with episode number 96 on this 7th day of August, I'd like to take a moment and say thank you to Sonic from Type 1 Radio, to Bill Klaus from Always Record, and to Violator from the Stygian Port. Both Will and I needed a break at various times this past month, and your help was invaluable. The results were tremendous also.
Tremendous?
Thank you. Tremendous. I'd also like to give a big warm thank you to Mr. William Morgan for carrying the microphone in my absence. My new son, Finn Douglas Vandegrift Bowles, appreciates it as well. Did you have a good break, Will?
I did, good sir, and don't worry about the thank you. It was the least I could do. How is little FD VDGB going, anyways?
He's a wild cat. He was born at dawn, so he has a sunny disposition. But when he is, I mean, he's also a Cancer, and this is a crabby little son of a gun.
Well, welcome back, Comey.
Well, it's good to be back, and you know what? Having a break was a pretty good thing, and having people step in and do shows for us was really cool too. And I think that I would really like to encourage people to do this for us. Contact us and say, I've got an idea for what Jeremy did, where it's a whole sync production. Or if you got a really cool interview that you think you can do in 42 minutes, then contact Will and I. And every once in a while, we do need a break. And I think as, you know, SyncBook Press begins to grow, if you know it's running on love right now, we're going to need to build in vacations just because we're killing ourselves a little bit lately.
Mm.
But saying that, I've got a number of cool things coming up this fall on the show. And who do we got today, Will?
Well, today we are resuming our initiation by going back into the Kabbalistic Tree of Life in Olympia, Washington, this time looking deeper as we explore this matter with its author, Andras Jones. Andras, actor, author, musician, synchhead, is most known for creating, developing, and hosting Radio 8-Ball, the pop oracle, which has been answering questions by picking songs at random since 1998. Currently, Radio 8-Ball is being utilized as a segment within the synchronized broadcast of which Mr. Jones is its co-host and co-creator. It can be found at thesyncbook.com/synchronize. Andras contributed a chapter to the SyncBook in 2011, which we've already discussed, and had the honor of publishing the first title on the newly created SyncBook Press imprint last year. Accidental Initiations, it is called, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia, which is the subject matter, of course, for tonight. It's a pleasure as always, Andras. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show and giving me an opportunity to talk about Accidental Initiations in the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia, and also just, get your reflections as two people who are super synchy who have read it. I'm curious to know what you want to ask about.
I am so glad it doesn't suck.
Thank you. Me too. The feeling is mutual about my book and your book.
Both of you guys had like a double pairing. Both your books came out at the exact same time. So that's really exciting to have you both being able to chit-chat. I mean, this is the first time that you, Doug, read Andras's book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I enjoyed it very much. I want to maybe put you on the spot a little bit. You begin the book with a couple epigrams, the first one a snippet of poetry by Walt Whitman, and then the second epigram is a larger chunk of text. And I'm curious, could you perhaps read this for us? And we start there? I mean,
yeah.
It's...
Let me grab the book here. So... read this opening. Does the what? Wait, well, it's Walt Whitman. You mean read the whole Yonkel the Mishmash come out?
Yeah. Do you think that would be too much?
Well, no. I can do that for you.
Oh, this is going
Yonkel
to be good.
The Mishmash come out. The children were in their beds, their grandfather sitting between them in the creaky old wooden chair, telling the familiar story when the storm hit, a maelstrom, a tempest, an apocalypse. You know what to do, boys, the grandfather barked as he took their hands. Yonkel the Mishmash, come out, the boys began immediately. Together the three intoned the invocation. Yonkel the Mishmash, come out. Their eyes locked and the chant harmonized with the storm. Yonkel the Mishmash, come out. There was a sudden explosion of light, and the boys rushed to the window. There in the pond sat a ship, a gloriously ramshackle impossibility of a vessel, manned by three unmistakable figures silhouetted in the moonlight, and a solitary being swatting at flies in a dinghy at the ship's aft. Their leader wore a pirate captain's hat and stood at the wheel of the awesome craft. I am Yonkel the Mishmash. I am here with the caveman, the Viking, and our most odorous companion, Uncle Pumpkey. At this, the man in the dinghy stood up to perform a bow and fell into a pile of what appeared to be fish guts and tissue paper. The storm is going to sink our boats, Mr. Mishmash, the boys cried through the window. Please make it pass us by. Immediately, the crew jumped into action. Yonkel steered his vessel, the Big Louie, into the storm. The caveman took the Viking's hand and began to spin him over his head, generating a powerful wind to fill the Big Louie's sails. Uncle Pumpkey, dressed in overalls and a bandana of indeterminate color, pulled himself roughly out of the garbage and climbed back onto the main ship. When Pumpkey's stench reached his nostrils, the caveman began to swing the Viking even more vigorously. Seeing this, Yonkel was struck with an idea. Get in there, Windstream, Pumpkey! Are you kidding? The Viking cried out through the caveman's revolutions. No, Yonkel bellowed. Send Pumpkey's vociferous noxification right into the heart of that blasted tempest. Do as I say, caveman. And so he did. And so it worked. The storm was no match for the powerful wind or Pumpkey's aroma. And as quickly as it hit, the storm vanished, as storms can and will sometimes do. Sailing back into invisibility, the Big Louie passed the boys' window, but by now they were fast asleep. Only the grandfather was there to wave an appreciative goodbye to the interdimensional heroes.
I need a drink.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Andras.
Thanks for giving me that opportunity to read that.
Did you write that?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's based upon bedtime stories that my grandfather, Lewis Smullen, told me and my brothers, and his kid is, it's a family story that has evolved through the years.
And so Yonkel the Mishmash is a beloved character.
Yeah. And the Viking and the caveman, and especially Uncle Pumpkey. Everyone loves Uncle Pumpkey.
Okay. And then
in his bandana of undeterminable
indeterminate color.
It's beautiful. It is just so beautiful and textured, isn't it?
What is does the mishmash? Can you unpack that a little bit?
I think it just comes out of sort of it's part of the I imagine that it comes out of the Yiddish background. Sort of it's like mishmash and pumpkey sound like Yiddish words to me, but I think it's also just my grandfather, who was a scientist. He was actually one of the people who helped develop laser technology at MIT. It was sort of his funny, creative side that he didn't get to express a lot. And he created it for his kids and then grandkids and then great grandkids, I guess. But I can't really, I mean, that's someone else's, that really is. One of the things about that I'm doing in Accidental Initiations, and this that story is one of them, is that I'm really there's a quote that Philip Roth, I believe it's I've heard it accredited attributed to Philip Roth, that he said, "When a writer is born into a family, that family's over." in response to people saying, like, because so much of a family is about the secrets and the intimacies. And that's the stuff that the writer takes and blows out and makes his own and gives to the world. And throughout the book, there are a lot of places where I tell the truth, where I name names, where I talk about things that I know there are people in my life who would probably rather I hadn't talked about them. I'm not saying that's the case with this story, but it is a case, it is one of the many cases in the story where I just took something that was true and put it in the book from my perspective. I sort of claimed it. And that probably, there's less of me in that particular section, but more of me. There's no comment on it. It's my way of sort of setting the tone and maybe having you feel a little bit like comfortable, like you are with your grandfather telling you a story. I mean, the book is dedicated to the children of Olympia. And I do have a sense that, I mean, even though it's not a book for children, I think that if you're adult enough to read it, it does speak to the inner child in us.
Okay, so here's one of my observations, and the reason why I think the book works so well is that you have an architecture that you state at the beginning, this Kabbalistic tree, and then you connect your life to that literary architecture. But not only that, you connect your life to the space that you inhabit, Olympia. And therefore, you make it universal that way. So it's not – and this is what's great about it, is that that architecture, the tree of life that you use as the metaphor for us to enter, we enter your life. But at that point in time, because it's a universal structure, it's, you know, it's not necessarily just your story. And so the reason why I bring this up is because you begin with the Walt Whitman – which is, you know, I think Walt Whitman, you know, of myself, I sing the body electric. And so this is definitely a body, you know, like a inhabited or embodied thing that we're doing. So it's not abstract. This is, you know, and that's what's fun, is it's a literal tree. But then the next epigram, and starting with there, this is, I was kind of curious because it's so playful. And it does set a tone, but the tone is stormy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess in that sense, it's sort of saying this, like the fairy tales are true, can be true, and this is true. And the only way that I was able to sail through it was to make it into a story.
Wonderful. In a way. Yeah. Yeah. And so that is like, if I have one question for you, it's like, you were inspired to do this by something. And then as you're doing it, you have some expectation in your mind, what this might become, or, you know, it, you know, what might be the result of the endeavor. My curiosity is what really was the result of the endeavor, you know, and what is the space between, and did you execute this with a subconscious intention and you weren't even aware of it? You know, I'm just wondering about the whole process.
I can answer that shit.
I was thinking that it'd be really fun because Will, through doing the films that he's done and studying, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways he knows me better than I know myself. And it'd be really funny to have Will answer the questions you have about the book. But since you only have one question.
No, I mean, I have lots of questions. Yeah. But that's, so it's like when I did my book, you know, I thought there was a goal that I was trying to achieve. And now that it's done, you know, it's like the book was successful for me because it achieved this thing that I didn't even realize that I was doing.
There's some of that. For me, the book, what that thing was the experience that came from writing the book. In short, first of all, when we're talking about the Kabbalistic tree, there is an actual Kabbalistic tree of life built into the city of Olympia. by the founders, the Freemasons who founded it. And it's a gigantic, like 2.5 mile walking labyrinth, a walking map of consciousness that is built into the city and has all these historic monuments in the city of Olympia. And this park is the end of the Oregon Trail, which if you extrapolate and think we're connecting Washington to Washington, and ending it here, there's a lot of import there. And I grew up in and around this tree. And so my life, when I sort of discovered it, I was 40 years old and I had a lot of life in me in and around this tree. I'd had a lot of experiences in and around this park throughout my life before I realized that the tree was there. And then the book started with me just honestly going out into that tree and walking it on the night of a lunar eclipse close to the solstice of 2011 and taking some psychedelics and came back and was super inspired. I had been thinking about wanting to write about the tree and also wanted to write about a lot of things. A lot of the chapters in the book were potentially whole books in themselves. Like the Kike chapter was a whole book in and of itself. I'm glad I didn't write it as a whole book because it's awful. You know, the Honor Among Men chapter really could be its whole book, and the Balanced Diet of Cults could really be its own book. But they ended up just being large chapters and important chapters in this book. But they were all floating around in my head and I didn't know where they fit. And then I went out and I had what you often will have in psychedelic experiences, which is something you're able to integrate very large picture thinking in your brain and have some way. And it just felt like the tree, I used the tree and I came down and I took everything in, and I knew what it was, what it had to be. And I went and started writing and I was exploding in this inspiration. And in the middle of that, I got fired from my job. Like in the middle of this moment of inspiration. And that was this huge sink. Not all sinks, a lot of people get confused. They think that all synchronicities have to be good or good feeling, but sometimes the most powerful ones are negative. And that's how the book ends, is this experience of that kicked off what became the book. And what's the real crazy synchronicity of this is that after exploding, I just kept writing. After when I got fired, I just kept writing. And what, you know, it turned into a very long, like 75 page, I don't know, like I sometimes call it like a suicide note, but it's not really a suicide note because it's like the thing you write to keep you alive. It's like a very intense conversation with my God in a way. And in the midst of this, I got invited to write a chapter for the Sync book. And I'd never been invited to write a chapter for any book. I'm known as a musician and as an actor. I might get called to act in a movie. That wouldn't surprise me. But getting a call to write a chapter for a book when I was exploding as a writer in a way that I never had before was a super synchronicity. And because I was right at the tail end of the Sync book, it meant that after I sent my chapter in, the Pop Oracle, which ends up being a chapter in Accidental Initiations, within like 3 weeks, Alan was in Seattle visiting with a copy of the book, and we walked the tree, and he said, "Hey, if you write about this, we could put it out." And I all of a sudden was an author who was writing a book that he knew was going to be published. And at that point, it was like the whole project was engaged with an energy that I just rode and continued to ride, you know, through this interview and will continue to ride through my life. I was already using the tree for super intense ritual. The book was like this crazy surprise. There was no, actually what I'm trying to say is there was no intention ever to write a book. Other than I kind of thought that'd be cool, but what I was doing was not writing a book. I was exploding because I didn't have anything else to do. And it was summer and I was going to keep the inspiration of that evening and not let other things sway me.
How old were you that summer?
2011, 12, 13, 40, 42, 43. I want to say 42 because it's 42 minutes, but I think I no, it's 42. Well, I'm turning 45 on August 12th.
Which
44.
summer was it? Which summer was it?
The 43. I was 43.
Yeah, because you and I are exactly 10 years apart. Almost to the day, because my birthday is July 25th, and your birthday, Mr. Jones, is next week.
August 12th.
Okay, and so it seems like some of your troubles also, I on page 55, I noted, you know, that you began having troubles at 40. Or no, I suddenly found myself studying the Kabbalah.
At 40.
At 40. Perfect.
He was a 40-year-old virgin.
Yep.
And in that Kabbalah class, which was not led, it was not a Jewish Kabbalah class by any stretch. In fact, I think it was kind of anti-Semitic in some ways, but still very good. I mean, that was very, as a very, you know, everything to me is a little bit anti-Semitic. just like I think everything's a little bit sexist if you're a woman. If you're a person who notices it, then you notice it everywhere. You know, if you're looking for fjords.
Right.
Thank you, Robert Anton Wilson. Anti-Semitism is my fnord.
looks like a bumper sticker to me in my mind's eye. That's
so. Since we're playing with words, one of the words that you unpacked culture in the diet, a steady diet of cults chapter, mm-hmm. which was wonderful because, you know, as far as taking something out of its normal context and saying, no, look, culture is a built thing of lots of different cults.
Right.
Yeah.
And we live in a time where you get to choose between, you know, you can be in the bodybuilding cult or you could be in the, you know, in the tantric sex cult, or you could be in Dianetics, or you could be into, you know, U.S. politics. They all have rules. They all have leaders. They all have, you know, initiations and gateways. They all have their own languages and their uniforms. And, you know, some of them get called cults and some of them get called baseball.
Society.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole idea of balanced diet of cults is that rather than looking at those as negative, it's like you have to be conscious, just like you're building a balanced diet of food in a world where you can eat pretty much anything you want to eat. You want to have a balanced diet of cults, you know, that, you know, Christianity is a good one in some contexts and not necessarily one for others. And the way I bust it up is by chakras. So like thinking of like, what's a good cult for your third eye? What's a good cult for your second chakra? What's a good cult for your heart chakra? What's a good, you know, and over life, building a balanced diet of cults so that you know where to refer for different kinds of intelligence, because they all carry different kinds of intelligence and they're useful. Like, I don't know, you might not be into the law, but if you ever have to go to court, it's good to like know how that cult works. That's a real good, I guess that's probably like a fifth chakra, like a throat chakra cult. It's all about language, you know. And making the whole world out of language, which is crazy making if you apply it to the whole thing, but it's useful at the level of that chakra when you have to deal with, you know, pure communication about life and death issues. That's one of the things I didn't talk about US law in the book, but that's the idea, is that any one of these things can be useful in its right moment, and that's why it's good to have a balanced diet and know what that, you know, what's available to you in the smorgasbord of philosophical delights.
One of the delights is that you share the mysteries of the universe on page 27. I'm not going to spoil it, but if you're a pubescent boy, I definitely advise you getting a copy of Accidental Initiations.
Oh yeah.
Are you certain that's a good suggestion, Doug?
Oh, totally. Come on, let's give it away. I mean, because I didn't make this up, so let's give it away. It's just all about like strengthening, like mastering your sexuality as a man is, you know, learning how to have control of your orgasm. And since everyone, well, for the best way to strengthen the muscle that gives you that control is that every time you pee, you stop your flow three times. And eventually you won't have to do that because you'll build up that muscle and you can just use it in your private sexual practice, whatever you do when you're alone, when you're working with your second chakra. But by that time you've familiarized yourself with that muscle, and the way that it's encouraged to familiarize yourself with that muscle is to stop your flow three times when you pee. Your girlfriend will appreciate it. So will you.
I did say this was an embodied book. We are
How
in
do you
our
think
bodies.
Finn Douglas happened?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it is a living document. There are the things that I write about in it are all true, and particularly true in the context of where they are placed in the book, in because each chapter is in relation to a different sephirot of the tree. So it's representing a different level of consciousness. Just like in the Balanced Diet of Cults, there's a different cult for every chakra. In your life, you might find that there's a different story. Like you have, you know, 10 different biographies. There's the biography as told by Malhut and the world of like what you made and what you did. And then there's the story of Tiferet or the heart and like what and who and how you loved. Mm. And those are those stories in your life, they run, you know, parallel to each other, but you can't tell them at the same time because they're two different consciousnesses. And that's how we're experiencing life, is all of these different consciousnesses. And that's why most of us go around being pretty crazy most of the time. It takes a lot. I mean, I think it really does take a lot to begin to turn that cacophony into a symphony. And that's certainly my practice. I've not mastered it, but I have my moments.
So, I mean, this is an accidental initiation, and therefore it's perfect because, you know, it's accidental. But I'm curious, if how would you execute it differently now? I mean, so this is, I mean, are you going to write another book? What kind
of? Well, I wrote the sequel, and it's on my blog, Accidental Initiation. If you go to accidentalinitiations.com, there's AI2, Accidental Initiations 2, which begins after I send the book to Alan and runs through the release of the book and the reaction to it, the negative reaction, the positive reaction, and the sort of weird synchronicities that showed up in the tree, you know, as graffiti or other things, you know, dead animals or whatever. And I actually think in a lot of ways that's stronger than the book. In my mind, the sequel would really be, the next thing would be the documentary about, like, someone who read the next installment, AI2, and then filmmakers to come and just document the tree. But if they're documenting the tree and I'm there, they're documenting me, and then it'll reignite a lot of the controversies that are there. And it'll be a very interesting film, and how it plays out, I don't know. I'm still.
You like controversy, though.
Well, no,
this comes out in the book.
I don't. I think that's incorrect. I think that.
No. I didn't know because he. That, and I
listen,
love
let
the
say.
The. Shmushkin in Exile. So you've got your balanced
no,
diet.
No, Shmushkin loves controversy.
Yeah.
Okay, Shmushkin adores controversy.
Okay, Shmushkin created his own hate group.
Yeah.
When his stuff was taking off.
But that's, I mean.
Is that classic Shmushkin?
That's classic. It was, you got to understand that that was for National Lampoon. And what Shmushkin and I both agree on is that the best of National Lampoon was Michael O'Donoghue. And he's one of the most confrontational comics ever. And so the idea of a Shmushkin record coming out on National Lampoon, and then having this hate group that was follow Shmushkin around.
But
and
so
turn
it,
his
but
shows.
Can you tell our listeners who Shmushkin is?
Shmushkin is a folk singer that I we share a family name. My family changed my name from Shmushkin to Smullen, and then my mom, Susan Smullen, married my father, Richard Jones, and that's why I'm a Jones. But my great-grandfather, Isaac Shmushkin, who I'm named after, my middle name is Isaac, he was actually a core member of the original Communist Party. He was, like, friends with Lenin and Trotsky. Like, before they were a Communist Party, they were just a party of communists, and he was at that party. At any rate, so, and then when I met Andy Shmushkin in L.A., we just totally gassed on each other. And it was a time when I was getting sick of myself as a musician, as a singer and as a musician, but I still loved writing and I had a lot of great connections. And so I started writing for him and producing his stuff. And just basically, he was my first client. And you can find his music. His songs are dirty and fun. And people only hear the dirty part, but they're really sweet and I think deeply philosophical songs. the ones that are the videos are less so, but Punkin' Lovin' is one, and the other one's Christmas Cunnilingus, which I think is actually a very, very profound song. I'm very proud of it. But we wrote a whole record together called Total Fucking Bullshit. And what we were talking about is that we had this idea to put together this fake hate group against Shmushkin that would show up at his shows. And then that fake hate group, the little improv class that was taking that on, with some pretty cool actors in it, actually, people who have gone on to some interesting things, they got taken over by some real wackos in the group and who took it seriously, which led to them being at, like, coming to, like, Shmushkin's big show in LA and, like, handing out flyers saying that Shmushkin is a child rapist, which is not true at all. At all. But it's funny from the standpoint of confrontational National Lampoons, you know, Michael O'Donohue, Andy Kaufman, John Belushi style humor. So, but as far as what you're saying about controversy, I don't think it's that I like controversy, but I do think that the status quo is passive aggressive and cowardly and about things that there's no need for them to be cowardly about. Like, just let's just talk about it. Let's address things. Let's argue. Like, that's not a bad thing. And that comes out of, you know, that's part of my Jewish heritage. Jewish kids are encouraged to argue and to be, you know, to be smart and argue and to, like, point things out. And I'm a Jewish kid who grew up in Olympia where, you know, I don't want to say that we invented being passive aggressive, but we've certainly perfected it here. And so, you know, the combination of being raised a certain way and constantly being confronted with a boring and hateful status quo makes me sort of a natural adjutant, and I've become comfortable with the results of that. But, you know, I only like controversy aesthetically, not, you know, and if only if it's really intelligent. But in general, it hurts. It sucks. But it's part of the outcome of being an adjutant. And I'd certainly rather be especially as a writer. What I wouldn't want to read a book. I tried to write the book that I would want to read, you know, something that is as frustrated with the, you know, that boring, hateful, passive aggressive, you know, thing as I am. And I think it's, you know, I don't think it's just in my town, but if it is, in a sense, maybe I only wrote it for my town or for my region. It's there in Boise, I'm sure. This whole Northwest is passive aggressive as hell.
Well, so let's talk about Olympia a little bit. It's interesting because at one point in time when I was reading, it reminded me of Dante in Florence, where his career, they exiled him, and he just dreamed about going back. I mean, so for you, you're kind of there, but the boring haters are putting up this wall of unpleasantness between awesome and you at times.
Right. No, it's, I mean, it is, I definitely had a sense of it being in the, in that tradition of, I don't want to say that I'm in this club, but I like this club of visionary writers in exile pining for the poetic home that is lost to them, whether they're able to be there or not, whether it's Joyce in Dublin or Dante in Florence, or any number of, you know, poets of great poets in exile. Again, I'm not saying I'm a great poet in exile at all. I'm saying this isn't that tradition. It's like saying that a song is Beatlesque. I'm not saying I'm a Beatle, but I know how to work those chord changes and I know how to take the stance. And there are some weird, crazy syncs around this with James Joyce, because that the day that I took the psychedelics and it got inspired was on, I believe it was June 16th, 2011, which is Bloomsday, the international celebration of James Joyce.
Right.
And I only realized that after the book came out. Shows how smart I am. I don't think I'm that smart.
I have to ask the question.
And ask. Then,
okay, but it might not even be important anymore. So this is one of the loud questions in the book. Why isn't Radio 8 Ball on Chaos? Does it matter anymore to you? Or, I mean, so like that's what I was getting at the beginning with. So that was one of the things, the injustices that you were addressing. But did this book kind of bring you peace in some level?
No. No. I mean, yes, it has. It has brought me peace in the level that I think anyone who is a victim, and in this case, I was a victim of weird kinds of abuse, some bureaucratic and some very personal, that it helps to tell the story. That there is a piece that comes from sort of like, I never have to tell the story again. I can just hand someone my book. If they want to know why I'm troubled over this, and if someone wants to know the answer to that question, why isn't Radio 8 Ball in Chaos? You can read my book and you can really hear my point of view on specifically the dynamics that led to that. But I also think that this is like, I write about that in the chapter that is relates to Guevara, severity, justice, relating to the right shoulder and the cut in the tree. And I will never stop fighting that battle. My Evergreen is where the school that my father helped to build. It's where Radio 8 Ball was born. It's where I spent my youth. And I don't acknowledge the authority of the people who put me in exile to do that. And I will, you know, at the very least, I'll outlive them. But more than that, I will continue to build what I'm doing to a point where I can raise this issue again and again and again, because it's the truth. It's not like something that is ever going to not going to stop being true. And I'm not, my connection to that land and that place and is not going to go away. But right now I'm not focused on it that much, but I do hope that if people read Accidental Initiations, the more people who read it, the main reason I'd like for the book to be a success in the sense of a lot of people reading it is that if a lot of people read it, the forces at Evergreen and at Chaos will have to address this issue, which is something they've never done. They've just told lies about me and now I have my version of the truth to contradict those. So no resolution, but I want to say, this is one of the points, like there is no resolution in life. That's one of the things that fools us. And it's one of the things that I actually do really like about this book is that it's not resolved. it is active and alive, and it raises lots of questions, and there are ways in which it's inconsistent and troublesome. And, I think obviously more obviously written by someone who is exploding with inspiration than someone who's a particularly great writer. And so the lack of resolution, that continuing agitation, is what life is. As Smushkin said in one of the new songs on that we're working on for a record called Mustache Music, he says, if enlightenment is the goal, then I may have overshot it. For all that I have learned or have yet to divine is that happiness is our birthright, but our bodies weren't designed to hold that state consistent or even very long. So the purest joy I know is just the singing of a song. And that's it. We tell our story and we suffer through life. But when we're telling our story or enjoying someone else telling their story, we're transported and life becomes like that fairy tale, like the Yonkle the Mishmash. The lightning strikes and something magic happens. And that's a synchronicity, or that's just, the moment, depending upon how you see that moment. But for those of us who, like all of us in this conversation, me being me talking at you, that moment is synchronicity. It's always there. There's not a moment that doesn't contain synchronicity. And if you go mad enough, in the middle of a Kabbalistic tree of life that you grew up in and around, you might accidentally write a book.
Thank you. You've been listening to Andras Jones on 42 Minutes, a production of Syncbook Radio and thesyncbook.com. More information about the work of Mr. Jones and Radio 8 Ball can be found at radio8ball.com. For more information about the Syncbook, our guests, to check out past shows, or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com.
I want to say, send people to accidentalinitiations.com. It's a better site right now.
Okay. So. Hit us with the is it just accidentalinitiations.com?
Yep.
Okay. If you like what you hear and would like to donate, please do.
Please do.
Please click the green back next to the episode on our website, and thank you and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Oh, Douglas is rusty. Douglas is rusty.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Have a good night.
Thanks a lot.